Welcome to Prostate Cancer Without Taboo, a podcast produced by Procure with the goal of helping, supporting, and informing men at risk, newly diagnosed people, survivors, and their families. Prostate cancer is the most common cancer in men. It is also the third leading cause of death, and in Quebec alone, 12 men a day are diagnosed with it. Yet, it is still a taboo subject for many. Procure podcasts are intended to be frank and transparent discussions with patients, caregivers, doctors, each with their personal stories and experiences with the disease. We hope that this tool will answer questions that you may not have dared to ask, and above all, will allow you to see that you are not alone. We remind you that Procure offers a 7-day-a-week telephone and online support service with nurses specialized in uro-oncology to answer your questions and concerns. We're here for you and your loved ones, so contact us.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Prostate Cancer Without Taboo, our podcast series that I hope will answer some of your questions or concerns. I am Marie-Christine Beauchemin, your host from Procure. Today's theme, tests, imaging, and biomarkers for prostate cancer, is particularly interesting because there are various methods to monitor this disease before, during, or after treatment. That is why, without further delay, I would like to welcome our guest, Dr. Danielle Lewinstein, surgeon uro-oncologist from the Hospital Charlemagne. Welcome, and thank you, Dr. Lewinstein, for accepting our invitation to participate in this podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with biomarkers. First of all, what are biomarkers?
So, biomarker, simply, it's a lab test either done on blood or urine or on saliva to objectively measure the level of some protein or molecule of interest. And usually this molecule will provide some level of predictive benefit with respect to incidence of disease, progression of disease, response to treatment, or even evidence of recurrent disease.
All right. And which specific biomarkers are relevant to prostate cancer screening and management?
In Canada now, what we're using is a PSA. We used to integrate other less known ones, such as PSA3 in urine and free PSA. In addition, in the U.S., there are other different biomarkers that are offered that are all commercialized tests, such as the Oncotype 17 gene assay. There's the 4K score. There's the PHI score. But in Canada, for the majority of Canadians with access to urologic care, will be the PSA.
And what are the primary screening tests used to detect prostate cancer, and how do these tests work?
So the basic screening test is the PSA, or the prostate-specific antigen. It's a lab test whereby your blood is drawn and the level of the specific protein is evaluated. This test has been around now since around 1989, and it's used for screening. The recommendation for screening in Canada by urologic care is to start screening at 50 in white males and to start at 45 in patients of African American descent, and in addition to having a family history such as a brother or a father with prostate cancer early on. As well, we also suggest getting a digital rectal examination either by your family doc if they feel comfortable with that, or by a urologist after referral.
All right, and one question that actually comes back from our patients, can PSA levels vary between different laboratories?
It can definitely vary. The PSA tests are essentially commercially available assays to check for the level of PSA. There's a couple of companies that produce the assays. There's Roche, there's Beckman, there's Hybritech. They're all essentially quite similar right now. That being said, definitely going from one lab to another, you can have some inter-lab variability. Within the same lab, usually the levels are quite reliable, though.
And should blood tests always be taken at the same time of the day?
PSA doesn't vary with the daytime versus the nighttime. There's no diurnal variation, such as, for instance, with cortisol or with testosterone.
All right. Can PSA levels be elevated without any specific reasons or due to other problems?
Definitely other things can cause PSA elevation, such as infections, acute infection. A patient that presents, you know, to the emergency with an acute febrile UTI will definitely have an elevated PSA. Patients that have some level of minor inflammation, either due to sexual relations in the, you know, antecedent 48 hours, or some patients who do lots of biking may experience some mild elevations in PSA. As well, the major driver of increased PSA is BPH. So patients that have a larger prostate will definitely have higher PSAs. So a patient that has a prostate, let's say, of 20 cc's should have a PSA that's lower than a patient that has a prostate of 100 cc's.
I see. Now, is there a reason why family physicians rarely perform the DRE as part of the screening?
I think there may be a couple reasons. You know, there's evidence published in the literature that suggests that the DRE doesn't add a lot to the predictive ability of screening of PSA due to the fact that it's not sensitive and nor specific. As well, probably the family doctors maybe don't do a lot of DREs and may not feel comfortable with their ability to properly evaluate for the existence or not of a nodule, and may tend to defer that evaluation if there's an elevated PSA to a urologist.
Now, not necessarily being linked, but the fact that some family doctors are not necessarily comfortable conducting a DRE. Since the pandemic, have you observed an increase in advanced prostate cancer cases at diagnosis?
I know we definitely saw a lot less prostate cancer during the pandemic due to, you know, loss of screening. I think the number of cases of advanced prostate cancer during the pandemic were stable, however. Now, the time frame, I think, is a little bit too short for me to give you the definitive answer, and I can't say that we have seen a large increase in metastatic disease over the last year.
All right. Now, who should absolutely undergo screening for prostate cancer?
So, you know, based on good data from various screening trials, specifically, you know, the ERSPC trial, urologic surgeons in Canada suggest screening, you know, Caucasian men at 50 and above, males that are of African descent at 45, and those that have family history, so i.e. a brother or a father that had early onset prostate cancer, which is technically defined as under 60, but obviously a patient that had a prostate cancer at 61, 62 is going to be just as pertinent. And this screening was shown actually to decrease mortality by about 30% in the largest screening trial to date, which was conducted in Europe. This screening should also continue until about 75, and this is really based, the upper limit was really based as a recommendation from Canadian Urologic Association on life expectancy. That being said, obviously, a patient that's 75 that's quite sick is one type of patient. A patient that's 75 that runs marathon is another, and their life expectancy might be much longer. Therefore, you may consider continuing PSA screening in a patient that is quite fit and has a clearly much longer life expectancy than the average patient in Canada.
And what about a man with first-degree parent, you know, battling other types of cancer?
So definitely what we know now is patients who have a family history of breast cancer could be in their father, which is obviously quite rare, or in their mother. If that mother or sister tested positive for BRCA2 or BRCA1 specifically in breast cancer, that definitely confers a higher risk in those men of having prostate cancer and a more aggressive form of prostate cancer. We generally don't do genetic testing on patients before they have a diagnosis of prostate cancer. However, a patient that was diagnosed with prostate cancer, there are certain instances where we may consider a screening for the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes, most specifically in patients where they're probably a candidate for active surveillance, but where their genetic profile may confer them a higher risk for recurrence or progression, and we may consider treating those patients up front.
I see. Let's talk about biopsy and imaging techniques for prostate cancer. Can imaging tests such as the MRI confirm the presence of prostate cancer without a biopsy?
So definitely standard of care in Canada and the U.S. is still a biopsy to confirm the diagnosis. There are, however, some centers in Germany that I'm aware of that are actually operating patients based on a positive MRI and a positive PET scan. That being said, that is clearly not the standard of care globally. Here in Canada, standard of care is to do an MRI. If that MRI shows a lesion which is considered to be of high risk, i.e. what we call PI-RADS 4 or PI-RADS 5, then we would clearly suggest a biopsy in that patient. There are, of course, some patients that have negative MRIs that will still harbor high-grade prostate cancer, and approximately 7 to 8% of patients that have a negative MRI will still harbor some prostate cancer that merits treatment. And we explain that to patients. You know, we give them the numbers. There's even better tools to really risk stratify patients out based on the size of their MRI, based on their PSA, based on their age, based on if they've had a prior biopsy that's negative. We can even hone in with more certitude than just MRI alone to really give them a number as to what their risk is of having prostate cancer that merits treatment despite having a normal MRI.
Are biopsies typically painful, and how long do they last, and what are the potential side effects?
So prostate biopsy, the standard technique is to go through the rectum and with an ultrasound probe to guide a needle biopsy, essentially a core biopsy that takes out pieces of prostate. The standard is taking 12 cores. We divide the prostate into six sextants, and we take two cores from each sextant. It usually lasts about 10 to 15 minutes. Patients usually receive some type of local anesthesia through the ultrasound probe, but generally around the prostate into the seminal vesicles to diminish pain during the procedure. The risks of the procedure specifically are bleeding. So it's quite rare, but about a 1 in 300 patients will have a bleed that requires some type of intervention or a transfusion. And obviously that risk increases in patients that are on anticoagulation, may have to restart their anticoagulation rapidly based on the reason for which they were on anticoagulation. The other risk, of course, of a biopsy is infection. Infection rates really vary from province to province and place to place. It's based on essentially resistance to the antibiotic that was given pre-biopsy. The standard is ciprofloxacin, and depending on the resistance in that community or in that area, that would increase that patient's risk of infection. We used to quote patients' risk here in Quebec specifically of around a risk of 4% of having sepsis post-biopsy. That's drastically changed over the last couple of years due to the introduction of transperineal biopsy, whereby the needle no longer goes through the rectum and instead goes through the skin of the perineum, and in essence allows us to avoid stool and soiling of the vasculature with the bacteria that are in the stool.
Now, speaking of the biopsy and the whole procedure, and the MRI test that we just talked about right before, could the MRI results actually lead to postponing or not going through with the biopsy?
Definitely, you know, a patient that has a mildly elevated PSA, let's say a patient that was 57 that had a PSA of 4, that it would trigger an MRI, and the MRI said there was no lesion. You definitely could consider avoiding biopsy in that patient. As I said before, we could really give that patient a quite accurate number as to what their risk is of harboring cancer that we call significant, which essentially is cancer that requires treatment. And those patients could avoid a biopsy. And in general, the trials that looked at the utility of MRI and risk stratifying patients before biopsy are able to reduce the number of biopsies about 25 to 40%.
All right. Now, speaking of biopsy again, does the prostate regenerate itself after a biopsy, or does the biopsy leave small holes into the prostate?
It there's no holes that are left in the prostate. The prostate is consistently growing. You know, it has receptors on its cells that interact with testosterone from the testicle, and so there's constant growth. It doesn't particularly grow cells more in that area, but the prostate itself is constantly growing, and the holes that are made during biopsy are immediately closed off by compression from the cells beside where the biopsy was taken.
And what is the risk factor of spreading cancer cells to surrounding tissues during a biopsy or repeated biopsies?
There's no known even case reports of having a seeding of the biopsy tract during a prostate cancer biopsy. You know, prostate cancer is a tumor that's solid and it's within a solid organ. And organs that have a solid tumor in a solid organ, there's essentially no risk of having spread, such as in other types of tumors, whether that be in the adrenal or lesions of the bladder.
Do you have questions, concerns, worries? Contact us 7 days a week at 1-855-899-2873 to discuss confidentially with one of our nurses specializing in uro-oncology, who will take the time to listen to you and provide you with informed answers. The ProCure support team is there for you.
What imaging techniques are available and how do they help in staging and monitoring the disease? Here I'm speaking about MRI, CT scans, or bone scans. How do they work?
Yeah, so MRI, so like I said, we already did it to risk stratify the patient. So the majority of Canadians now in 2023 that are going to be worked up for an elevated PSA are going to get an MRI before their biopsy. So we already have that information. MRI is going to give us a couple of useful informations. One, it's going to tell us, as I said before, is there a lesion or not in the prostate? Two, it's going to tell us, does the radiologist that reads the MRI think there's disease outside the prostate, so transgression of the capsule and causing what we cause a locally advanced disease? As well, the radiologist can comment on whether they think the neurologic bundles, the nerves, may be implicated in the tumor. And that may give information to the urologist to not try and save the nerve on that side if they were to do a prostatectomy in that patient. As well, the radiologist will also comment on the implication or the involvement of the seminal vesicles with the cancer. And that sometimes will preclude the ability to deliver radiation to those patients. We also can have some degree of sensitivity to know whether there are lymph nodes that are in the drainage area of the prostate in the pelvis, and somewhat even higher. The next type of staging test that we have for disease outside the prostate, we have scanning, so standard computer tomography scanning, where we scan the abdomen, the pelvis. We may consider also scanning the thorax, which we are doing more and more. And the utility or the goal of the scanning is to know, A, are there lymph nodes? So are there lymph nodes in the pelvis in local drainage areas of the prostate? Are there lymph nodes in other areas in the upper abdomen, or possibly even higher in what we call the mediastinum, which is the area around the heart and the esophagus? As well, we're specifically looking for bony involvement, so patients that have a lot of bone metastases or significant or important bone metastases that will also be picked up on CT scan. And we also use bone scan. So that's the third thing we're going to do is in patients that have an elevated PSA above 20 or have a Gleason 8, which is a high-risk histology prostate cancer, or have what we think may be a locally advanced cancer based on our digital rectal examination, we would also ask for a bone scan in those patients. And that specifically to look at bony metastases, and the bone scan is more sensitive than the CT scan. What that means is that we're able to pick up smaller lesions than we would on standard scanning. Finally, we are starting to use a little bit in the experimental stages, even in initial staging, is this PET PSMA test, which is essentially a type of PET test whereby a radioactive ligand is is attached to an antibody that targets PSMA. And PSMA is a protein on the surface of the cell of prostate cancers. And patients that are stricken with prostate cancer will have about a 1,000-fold increase of the PSMA protein on the surface of their cell. So the ability to detect where these radioligands are going allows us to see, A, where is their disease, and gives us some type of qualitative, also quantification of the amount of disease in a specific area.
Now, when should it be used? When should patients actually do this imaging test?
So if the patient is going to go on to elect to go on to have radiation therapy, let's say for a local disease, any patient would get a scanning, a bone scan and a CT scan, including even those that we consider to have what's called favorable risk disease, so really low risk of metastases. However, if a urologist is going to do a prostatectomy, we really try and follow the guidelines, and those are quite clear. So patients that need bone scans are patients that have a PSA of more than 20 pre-op, patient that has Gleason 8 or high-risk disease on histology pre-op, a patient that has what we think is locally advanced disease on digital rectal examination pre-op. Indications to do a CT scan is when we think the risk of having nodal disease is above 10%, and that can be calculated using standard nomograms or calculators that are based online at various centers of excellence in the U.S., where we can actually calculate with a very good certitude and accuracy the risk of having lymph node involvement. And if the calculation, which is based on the predictors such as PSA, Gleason score, the digital rectal examination, as well as, for instance, the number of cores that were taken out during the biopsy that are touched by cancer, we're able to calculate a fairly accurate number of risk. And if that risk is 10% or higher, we would suggest a lymph node dissection to the patient during surgery.
Now, when a patient has a recurrence, let's say after radiation therapy or radical surgery, can we use the PSMA test to see exactly where that recurrence is?
Definitely. So the PSMA test, which I repeat again, is technically experimental and has not become standard of care in Canada, is actually an excellent test to find out where disease is after recurrence. Standard of care for a patient that had a recurrence after definitive treatment, so that would be either radiation or surgery. And for instance, if a patient had surgery and they had a recurrence, which we would define now by a level of 0.1 and rising, standard of care would be to ask for a bone scan and a CT scan. But we know that even when we ask those tests, we're not going to find anything. It's more to document the fact that there is nothing. In general, patients that would have a slow-growing disease and is all coming on later, we consider to have local recurrence, whereas those that had a rapid recurrence and a fast-rising PSA, we'd consider those patients to be metastatic. Now we can actually image these patients, so we can do a PET PSMA, and the PET PSMA is much more sensitive than our bone scan and our CT scan. So what does that mean? It's that it can find disease where there is only a minimal amount of disease. So for instance, a patient that has a recurrence after prostate surgery that has a PSA of, let's say, 0.2 to 0.5, the sensitivity of the PET PSMA is around 50-60%. But if we can wait for that PSMA to go to 0.5, so a little bit higher, we can have a sensitivity of around 80-90%. So what that means is that if there is prostate cancer in the body somewhere, when you do a PET PSMA, you're going to have an accuracy of 90% of finding it. So you're able to find cancer much earlier and in smaller amounts than you would with standard conventional imaging. Just to add on to that as an adjunct, is the definition of recurrence after radiation is a little bit different. So those patients usually don't have PSAs that are undetectable after treatment ultimately, but we call their lowest value after treatment their nadir. And if a patient has a PSA that is rising and has reached 2 points above their nadir or their lowest value after radiation, that patient would be considered to have a recurrence. And that's also a patient within which we would consider doing PET PSMA scanning.
Is PET PSMA scanning used when a patient receives a metastasized cancer diagnosis, or if the cancer is actually progressing towards metastases?
So if we know someone clearly has metastatic disease on conventional imaging and it's quite clear the burden of disease, there's no role to really do PET PSMA in that patient. The roles of PET PSMA, the most utilized role is in recurrence and essentially finding out where is the recurrence, because we know there is one based on the biochemistry of the PSA being augmented, but we just don't know where it is. So the PET PSMA in the context of a post-treatment recurrence allows us to know where it is. And the other utilization is in a patient that we think has local disease, so has high-risk disease initially, and that patient might have had conventional imaging. We may consider doing PET PSMA imaging to find out if there's disease outside the prostate, despite the fact that we could not find it on conventional imaging.
Thank you. Now, how accurate is the PSA testing post-treatment?
So the PSA testing post-treatment is actually much more accurate than the pre-op or pre-radiation context. So PSA is not specific to cancer per se. It's specific to, or mostly specific to, cells and cellular turnover of the prostate. So a patient that has inflammation, infection, may have increased PSA in the preoperative setting, but in the postoperative setting, increased PSA is and rising is 100% a recurrence. So it's an extremely specific test and much more accurate in the postoperative setting than in the preoperative setting.
Now, why are some patients tested for testosterone levels along with their PSA test?
So testosterone, which is produced mainly at the level of the testicle, is the fuel for the prostate cancer. So patients that have metastatic disease or have locally advanced disease, their cancer grows as the testicle produces testosterone. So one of the mainstays of prostate cancer treatment that we've been aware of now since around the time of Huggins, so that's about 90 years ago, is that if we can shut down testosterone treatment, we can try and stop growth of prostate cancer. So patients that have advanced disease or metastatic disease, those patients are often on LHRH agonists, or they may be on an LHRH antagonist. And in those patients, we desire to have a blocked testosterone. We call it castrate testosterone, whereby the testosterone is at a very low level where it is unable to fuel the cancer cells. And in those patients, our desire is to have a testosterone quite low. So if we see that the testosterone is not properly blocked with one agent, we may consider adding on another agent, or we may consider changing agents to try to have a testosterone that is blocked so that the prostate cancer cells do not grow.
All right. And when we're speaking about agents here, we're referring to hormone therapy.
Exactly. Yes. Hormone therapy.
Okay.
Yes.
Perfect. Yeah. Is there a time when PSA testing is no longer relevant for patients treated, let's say for advanced prostate cancer? Or
I don't think there's a time where it's no longer relevant. There definitely are patients whereby the PSA doesn't predict their progression. You know, there's rare patients that have advanced disease, metastatic disease, that will have radiologic progression and clinical progression despite having a PSA that doesn't move. That's the minority. But some prostate cancers, which are glandular cancers or what we call adenocarcinomas, can sometimes transform into a different type of tumor, which we call neuroendocrine. And those type of tumors are aggressive and they do not produce PSA. So in some patients, they may not have to PSA progression, but have actual clinical progression. So even though in those patients it may not be as useful, we still would ask for a PSA follow-up for those patients. The only time we'd consider stopping PSA in the utilization in our office is really in patients that are screened. You know, we suggest that patients that are screened until around 75 years, but during the fact they've been diagnosed with disease, there's no real time to stop PSA testing.
All right. This is our last question. Where do you recommend patients find answers to their questions regarding testing or testing results between medical appointments?
So I think, you know, if patients have questions and they forgot to ask them during their appointment, or they came up obviously during or between two different appointments, there are great sources for information. You know, you have online, you have in Canada, the CUA, so the Canadian Urologic Association, has excellent information on all facets of urologic care and specifically prostate cancer is actually probably one of the most foremost with respect to the extensiveness of the information. As well, ProCure provides, you know, nurses and information 7 days a week. So patients that have questions with regard to diagnosis and lab testing and interpretation of lab testing and treatment options and possibly response to treatment may also consider asking those questions of health professionals that are working with ProCure as well. Sometimes patients may want to procure some information on the internet. And you always have to obviously be careful where you are getting your information, but some excellent sites to explain prostate cancer in general and all the different sub types of information would be the NIH or the National Institute of Health. So NIH.gov would provide good information, as well as cancer.gov, which are websites on the American government website, which provide information on various types of cancer, including prostate cancer. And the information is usually accompanied by videos and by nice drawings that help to explain the sometimes complex concepts.
All right, so a little bit of search and they will definitely find the right information, and we are certainly there to support them and answer their questions. Dr. Daniel Lewinstein, thank you very much for sharing this insightful information with us. That wraps up today's podcast. To all our listeners, thank you for tuning in. I hope this podcast has addressed some of your questions or concerns. So thank you, everyone, and see you next time. Again, thank you so very much, Dr. Lewinstein.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks. This is Marie-Christine Beauchemin for Prostate Cancer Without Taboo.
Thank you for listening to Prostate Cancer Without Taboo, a podcast produced by ProCure. To learn more about prostate cancer and our podcast episodes, visit procure.ca.